bifidobacteria are usually considered to be those friendly, healthy guys that are producing short-chain fatty acids like acetate and are doing, you know, good things for modulating the gut-brain axis. And so we found that bifidobacterium alone is able to increase mucus production using germ-free mice. And so we think that's really exciting too. Another way that bifidobacterium might be influencing the host has been bolstering that mucus layer so you have a more protective barrier, and then the microbes can have a different interaction too.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes, and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics. We're a nonprofit scientific organization also known as ISAP. In this podcast, you'll hear about emerging topics across the fields of biotic substances and microbiome science. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. I hope you enjoy this episode with your hosts from the ISAP Board of Directors, Professor Colin Hill and Professor Dan Tancredi.
Hi, everybody. My name's Colin Hill.
And I'm Dan Tancredi.
And today's guest is Dr. Mindy Ingevik, who's an assistant professor at the Medical University of South Carolina. And her particular interest is the interaction between commensal, beneficial, friendly bacteria and the human gut. And specifically, Mindy, you have an interest in mucus. Can you build a kind of a picture for us or for our listeners of how mucus, the architecture, if you like, of epithelial cells, mucus, lumen, all that whole environment, please?
Oh, absolutely. I'd love to paint a beautiful picture. So it depends on where you're at in the gastrointestinal tract, what the mucus looks like. So the gastrointestinal epithelium obviously is a single layer of columnar cells, and they have specialized cells known as goblet cells, which actively secrete mucus. So in the small intestine, the mucus is secreted and it kind of forms this light barrier that lines the villi and protects the crypts. And as you go down south into the colon, that's really where you have a lot more mucus producing cells. And deep in the crypts, you have all of this mucus coming out, and it ends up making these two layers of mucus. So you have an inner layer that's completely sterile and no bacteria penetrate it. And then you have an outer fluffy mucus layer where mucus associated microbes can really live and thrive.
So you have that, as you said, this kind of, when you look at confocal microscopy or something, you get this dark layer where there's no microbes present. But then lots and lots of people that I know work on, you know, microbe-host interactions. And they seem to imply that the microbes are right up against those epithelial cells and those, you know, immune cells that are interspersed along the epithelium. Do you disagree? Are they always acting at a distance?
So I think it depends on where you're at in the gut. So in the small intestine, I think you have a lot easier access to the host epithelium and bacteria could potentially interact with the host epithelium. But in the colon, you really are restricted by that inner sterile mucus layer. But that being said, in the setting of a pathogen, some of the bacteria are really good at degrading the glycans, and then some are actually good at degrading the mucin protein, and they can actually get in through that mucus layer and then infect you. But I would say that in general, I always love seeing a diagram where you see the bacteria sitting directly on top of the epithelium, and I think that that's not as common as it might be depicted.
So maybe this is a good time to get you to tell us what mucus is.
Yeah, well, mucus is incredibly important. It's a glycoprotein. So basically, you have a protein in every serine and threonine residue. You have these O-link glycans that make this basically a bottle brush structure. I like to think of it like a fuzzy caterpillar. It's just really protected by these glycans. And these glycans have all different types of structures. And a lot of the gut microbiome actually has the genetic capacity to degrade mucus in the fact that they have glycosyl hydrolases, which can cleave individual sugars off of these glycans. And so mucus is really cool because it's this interface between the gut microbiota and the host, and microbes do a lot of stuff with mucus.
So in particular, the microbes are actually using the mucus as a food source, and the mucus is kind of a critical part of the barrier for the gut barrier for the host then. So there's our interplay.
So, you know, like you have mucin degrading specialists, which have all the glycosyl hydrolases degrade to the different sugars. And then you have some that just have, you know, the ability to remove like galactose residues or N-acetylglucosamine. And so the mucus can provide a carbon source for bacteria to survive. And then additionally, bacteria also seem to interact with mucus in different ways. Like they can bind to the mucus and they can form biofilms on the mucus, and that allows them to colonize. And some microbes, we're doing some interesting work showing that quorum sensing is influenced by the presence of mucus. Some bacteria quorum sense and produce AI2, that universal bacterial language, when they're exposed to mucus. And we do know that mucus changes gene expression in some bacteria. So there's a lot of ways that mucus can actually influence the gut microbiota.
And then talk to us a little bit about our friends, the bifidobacteria, and their kind of important role with the mucus.
Yeah, I love bifidobacteria. It's my favorite. You know, we're not supposed to have favorites, but it happens to be my favorite friendly bacteria. And so bifidobacterium, obviously, really important in early life development and as well as in later life. And bifidobacteria are usually considered to be those friendly, healthy guys that are producing short-chain fatty acids like acetate and are doing, you know, good things for modulating the gut-brain axis. And so we found that bifidobacterium alone is able to increase mucus production using germ-free mice. And so we think that's really exciting too. Another way that bifidobacterium might be influencing the host has been bolstering that mucus layer so you have a more protective barrier, and then the microbes can have a different interaction too.
And you spoke about this mucus layer. Is it like almost like a conveyor belt, always moving down along the epithelial surface, or is it fixed in place? I know it sloughs off and gets, you know, carried away in feces and so on. What's happening there? And if a bacterium attaches to it, is it destined for ejection at a later point?
Yeah, it's very complicated. I feel like it's very Game of Thrones in the gut. You know, you got to do a lot to survive. So obviously the gut epithelium is shed in mice. It's every like 3 to 4 days. In humans, it's every like 5 to 6 days. And so your entire lining of your gut is basically shed. And so as you might imagine, you have a lot. The mucus is expelled and gets sloughed away, and then the epithelial cells are being constantly renewed. So there's a lot of movement downwards. And so in theory, if you're binding to mucus, you're not necessarily going to want to stay on that exact mucus spot your entire time, or you will get expelled from the gut. So there clearly is dynamic interactions that have to occur for bacteria to bind, to colonize, and then to shift their home, if you will.
And pathogens, of course, many pathogens are motile, and they can, some are even almost corkscrew shaped, and they can burrow their way through the mucus. Is there any evidence that commensals do that as well and penetrate the mucus and really do get up close and personal with the epithelial cells?
Most of the bacteria the commensal bacteria aren't amazing at degrading the mucus. Like Akkermansia mucinophila is one of the ones that is really good at degrading the mucus, but it also seems to increase mucus production. So there's this nice homeostasis where a lot of pathogens, they'll degrade the mucus and then they'll cause inflammation, and inflammation will suppress mucus. And then that allows other luminal antigens to get closer to the host epithelium and kind of stimulate a cycle of inflammation, at least on a local level. So, you know, I haven't seen a lot of evidence that the commensal bacteria really degrade a lot of the bacteria and get close to the epithelium, but I think the mucus is a great platform for bacteria to then secrete metabolites in pretty close proximity to the host epithelium. And I think a lot of the metabolites are really influencing gut health.
Can you talk to us, Mindy, from your systems biology perspective of how the regulation of mucus production from the commensal bacteria might open up new pathways to treat human disease?
Yeah, so there are a lot of disorders in the human gut that involve decreased mucus. One of the most prominent is inflammatory bowel disease. A subset of those patients, ulcerative colitis patients, have less mucus production. Their mucus is less glycosylated, so it's not as good of a barrier. And so the thought is that if you can identify metabolites or bacteria that are able to then increase mucus production, increase glycosylation, and help bolster that barrier, we could then reduce inflammation and maybe help those patients resolve their inflammation. And so I think this is a really exciting step. If we can figure out what bacteria are secreting, we can harness that and then use that to treat the disorders that are involved with a lower mucus barrier.
Is that a situation where if there's a bad status of the mucus, that it kind of favors bad acting bacteria and makes it harder for the good guys to establish themselves?
You know, I think bacteria are really smart. They have some really interesting strategies. So I think pathogens do try to subvert the host and create an environment where commensal bacteria will be excluded so that they can basically be king of the hill. So I do think that there is some strategy in pathogens. When they infect the host, they cause inflammation. Inflammation suppresses mucus. And then it creates an unfavorable environment for commensal bacteria. So, you know, if you're a commensal bacteria, you want to maintain your niche and exclude the pathogenic microbes. So I think there's obviously this constant battle that's occurring, but you know, those pathogens are pretty smart.
When you study mucus production and the role of mucus, what kind of model systems do you use? Are they cell lines which have goblet cells in them? Mice models, rat models? How do you do it? Because I presume you're not constantly probing humans for mucus samples.
Yes, you are not wrong about that. We have a lot of different models at our disposal, which is exciting. So we can use mucin-producing cell lines. There are several ones like the LS147 cells, TD4 cells will produce mucus, H29 TX cells. But those are all cancer-derived. So we really kind of shifted away from using those traditional cell lines and moved more towards using human intestinal organoids. So we can take biopsies from along the length of the gastrointestinal tract, and we can grow up those stem cells and then differentiate them to become all the cell types of the body, including goblet cells. And then if you inhibit Notch signaling with like a gamma secretase inhibitor, you can actually drive most of the cells to become goblet cells as well. So that's kind of a tunable model. You can kind of get the normal distribution of goblet cells, and then you can ramp up the goblet cells if you want to. And then, of course, if we're interested in studying how an individual bacteria might influence mucus production to really understand what bacteria are capable of doing, we love using the germ-free mouse model or notobiotic animals, where we can add that bacteria. And germ-free mice at baseline have less mucus production than conventionalized mice that have a complete gut microbiota. And so we can use that as a way to assess how a single microbe can actually influence goblet cell production and mucus maturation.
And do you think it's a very heterogeneous colonization or more homogeneous? For example, we did a study a year or so ago now where we took biopsy samples just a centimeter apart in the same animal model, in macaques and in pigs, and found quite different microbiotas, even a centimeter apart in the same area of the... Does that surprise you, or would you say absolutely what I'd expect?
I would say that that's what I would expect, because I feel like every place in the gut is like a neighborhood, right? Every bacteria has certain friends and certain niches. And so I'm not surprised at all that different regions are dramatically different in terms of the microbiome composition. And, you know, I think that it's really cool that microbes have a selective community that they like to associate with. And I think that we're only just beginning to figure out how those interactions are occurring.
Can you talk to us a little bit about some of the work you've done in terms of understanding the bacterial metabolites and how they influence health? Like, for example, I know you've done some very cool stuff with folate synthesis.
Yeah, so like I said, we like to use some of our in vitro models to be able to assess like what a bacteria is capable of doing, so we can grow up a bacteria in a chemically defined media and just assess, you know, by mass spec what it's capable of producing. And then we can add those metabolites to organoids or add it to a germ-free mouse model and assess what it can do, you know, by itself. And then we can also grow those microbes up as a community, because obviously, you know, no human has it. It's just a single microbe growing inside of them. So I think, you know, analyzing how bacteria interacts with its friends is really important. And so we can kind of then get these defined communities and then assess how they're influencing the metabolite production and then add those to cells. And so we have done some cool stuff with Lactobacillus reuteri and looking at folate, and we made some mutants to show like the different parts of folate. If it was not able to produce all of the proper folate stuff, how does that influence the gut epithelium using our organoid model? And so I think there's a lot of cool stuff. It's great time to be a microbiologist right now.
And I know you've done some work, Mindy, as well with Clostridioides difficile and Fusobacterium and the interaction of those and the mucus. Could you describe some of that work? Because that's an organism, I think, that's really fascinating organism in and of itself, but obviously quite a problem in hospital settings.
Yes, it's my favorite dark side bacteria. So, you know, it's kind of like the Force. You have the Jedi and the Sith. I like to think of C. diff as, you know, a Sith overlord. So it's a great model, though, because it's one of those diseases where the gut microbiota directly influence whether or not C. difficile can colonize. So as a healthy individual, I have a complex gut microbiota community that will exclude C. diff. But if I'm on antibiotics and I shift my microbiome, then C. diff is able to establish a niche and colonize, and it creates inflammation. And, you know, like I said, kind of king of the hill situation, it tends to dominate. So we've been interested in how when C. diff colonizes, who it's interacting with as well. And one of the bacteria that we surprisingly found was Fusobacterium nucleatum, which is normally an oral cavity microbe, but it is present, especially in inflammatory bowel disease patients. Just at baseline, they have elevated levels of Fusobacterium in their biopsies. And we found that Fusobacterium and C. diff actually physically interact with each other. The flagella of C. diff binds to the RAD-D protein of Fusobacterium, and they form these really nice complex biofilms that are then more resistant to antibiotics. And we don't think that's a wonderful thing if, you know, we're trying to treat patients and try to eradicate C. diff if it's making these biofilms that are a bit more antibiotic resistant. So that's kind of it's interesting to see these synergies. And, you know, we would like to identify commensal bacteria that can interrupt this interaction and prevent C. diff from creating such a good niche.
Mindy, you've been one of the explorers to try to define that elusive concept of what is a healthy gut microbiome. I'd be interested to hear your reflections over your very productive career. That's, you know, as an, I'm impressed that you're an assistant professor. You've done so much great work. But can you reflect a little bit on how your own thinking of what is a healthy gut microbiome has evolved?
Absolutely. I mean, thank you so much, by the way. That's such a kind compliment. First of all, I think it is a $1 million question is, what is really a healthy gut microbiome? We all want to define it. We want to know what we should be at. And I think it's an incredibly complicated question. Clearly, we have huge variability between individuals, and my healthy gut microbiome might look very different than, you know, somebody down the hall from me. So I think it's really important for us to try to figure out not only who's there, but functionally what they're doing. Because we know there's a lot of redundancy in the gut microbiota. We don't need to have the exact same bacteria, but we need to have the same function. And so I think it's been kind of wonderful for us as microbiologists to be able to explore the cartography of the gut and try to figure out who is important and then what are they doing that's important and how does that impact those hosts. And I don't think we're quite there yet, but I think obviously with the advent of 16S sequencing and metagenomics, we're getting much closer to like really understanding who's there and kind of what they're doing. And I think that as we go forward in the future, we'll be able to get that more in depth. But I think it's an exciting time. I don't think we know yet, but I'm hoping 20 years down the line, we'll be able to be like, yes, these are the microbes I want in theory, but this is really what the function is that, you know, that I'm really trying to shoot to get them to be at.
And you make the point, Mindy, and you're absolutely correct, of course, that all three of us, let's hope we all have healthy microbiotas, but they may well be different and almost certainly are different in all three of us. But are the chemistry of our mucus, is that also different in each individual? And how much do you think is that a driver of individual microbiome populations and, you know, composition?
Well, so at least in terms of the protein level, all of us have MUC2. That's really the dominant secreted mucin that forms that protective barrier in the gut. However, bacteria do influence the amount of glycosylation that occurs on that protein. So our glycan structure might be different depending on the microbes that are inside of us. And then, of course, as the microbes degrade the mucus, that might be different from person to person. And that does really influence how bacteria behave. And so I do think that there is, you know, this idea that we really need to figure out the network. We need to figure out how bacteria interact with each other, how they interact, I think, with the mucus layer, and ultimately what type of metabolites are then being influencing the host. And the host is responding, you know, by producing mucus as one example. But I think there's a lot of cool work that could be done in the future. But I do think it does differ. We do know that along the length of the gastrointestinal tract, the mucus glycan composition differs from person to person. It can differ. And so I think that hopefully with like a lot of computational modeling, we can maybe figure out like some of those interactions a little bit better.
And you mentioned earlier biofilms forming along the mucus layer. And that always fascinates me. Do you think that these biofilms, that the bacteria are literally almost, you know, breaking down a bit of mucus, handing it to the next guy almost who's, you know, shoulder to shoulder with it? Or they just release them and they kind of diffuse away and someone snaps them up again? Do you think they're really working almost like production lines to break down the mucus? Or how do you think, what's your view on that?
Yeah, I don't necessarily think that the sugars that are released are just kind of going out into the universe, if you will, that they are very spatially restricted. So if you have a neighbor right next to you that's well-equipped to take up those sugars, you know, they'll be able to take it up and cross-feed and give you then maybe the byproduct that you're really interested in. So I do think that there is a very thoughtful way that bacteria come together in a community and that they are kind of basically handing off things to their friends to help, you know, create this synergy and this really complex community interaction that then ultimately helps all of the organisms together. But yeah, I feel like assembly line.
Mucus, obviously, we are talking about the mucus in our gut, but there are mucus on many surfaces, many biotic surfaces. And are any of those good models for looking at interactions of bacteria? Are all mucus surfaces covered in bacteria in every niche in nature? Or do you know that?
Yeah, so I mean, mucus is really important. It's great for, you know, being a protective surface. It's good for hydrating. So anytime you have an environment that's exposed to, well, I guess, you know, body part that's exposed to the environment, you tend to have mucus production. So there's a lot of cool studies with fish mucus because fish are covered in mucus and the bacteria that colonize it influence fish health kind of in a similar way that the microbiome influences our gut health. And so I think that's actually a really cool model. Also, coral have mucus and the coral microbiome is really influenced by mucus production. And I think that's really incredibly interesting. So I think there's a lot of interesting information that we can draw from other model systems that also have mucus microbe interactions that could then inform us of how the gut microbiota might be also functioning in a similar way.
Mindy, can I ask you a question that has to do with the myth, a sort of a persistent myth that goes back to the great philosopher and physician Maimonides, that milk causes excess mucus production, that is sort of a persistent myth that a lot of parents of children have. Can you talk a little bit about nutritional influences on mucus production, and what do you think are kind of good diets to try to favor a healthy mucus?
Well, so I think that actually that microbes are the intermediate for that. So obviously diet profoundly influences the composition and function of your gut microbiome. And then your microbes ultimately influence goblet cell production of mucus and the glycosylation of that. So I would say that that really depends on the bacteria that you have. But, you know, in general, if you want to have a healthy microbiome that is shown to produce more mucus, you want to have high dietary fibers. There's some amazing work out there that shows that when you feed mice a high fiber diet, that it increases the levels of bifidobacterium and subsequently increases the amount of mucus that's being produced by the goblet cells. And so I think that, you know, trying to eat a healthier diet, less high fat, high sugar here, but and more of those non-fermentable fibers are a really beneficial way. And I think also we're getting more towards fermented foods. Fermented foods seem to significantly impact the gut microbiome, and that seems to have a beneficial effect on the host. And mucus is one of those ways why that's one of the things that's being also being influenced.
And you mentioned earlier as well, Mindy, the Acromantia mucinifera, which is this extraordinary, almost professional mucus degrader in the gut. And, you know, it's been shown as well to have specific health benefits when it's administered as a probiotic or as a postbiotic. Why hasn't every bacterium in the gut evolved to become a mucus degrader? I mean, there's this extraordinary source of protein and sugars. And why isn't everybody sitting at that dining table and attacking it?
Well, you're not wrong. Acromantia is really a specialist. It's amazing at degrading mucus. I think, though, that it has clearly established a niche, and it's a really beneficial niche for that bacteria. But diet is a wonderful source of nutrients for bacteria as well. So a lot of bacteria, like Bacteroides in particular, are able to degrade mucus if they need to, and then also can switch back to the diet when whatever the conditions are favorable. So I think that a lot of bacteria have the capacity to switch back and forth, and they're less specialists of the mucin because there are these dietary components that they're pretty good at scavenging and using. And so I think that, you know, if you're a bacteria and you want to hedge your bets, maybe don't put all of your eggs in one basket. And so I think a lot of bacteria do both because it's advantageous for them. But Acromantia has figured out its niche. It's really good at degrading mucus.
Speaking of figuring out a niche, can we talk a little bit about career? What kind of advice would you give to aspiring systems biologists for figuring out their own niches?
Yeah, I think, like I said, it's exciting to be a microbiologist. I think there's amazing tools out there to be able to ask these complicated questions and really figure out some insights into the microbiome. So I recommend, you know, for graduate students that are thinking about postdocs to think about the types of experimental things they want to be doing in their future and to go into labs that have that expertise. And so, you know, I think that it's important to be mindful of the type of work that you want to be doing and to really become an expert in that. But there's always, you know, don't lose heart if you go into something and you decide, oh, that's not really what I want to do. I feel like there's a lot of options. There's workshops that are available to teach you computational work, and there's resources. You can go and visit a lab, cool techniques. And I think it's just a really exciting time to be a scientist and really be studying microbes.
And Mindy, I know you've been very active as well in science communication. And I'm told that you're known as Micro Mindy is your handle. Can you tell us something about that? Why did you get into it in the first place? And what's your method? Is it social media? Or do you think just regular reviews in scientific journals? I mean, how do you try and communicate with, and who are you trying to communicate with?
Well, I think that the pandemic really showed us that scientists are not doing as great of a job as we could be at communicating to the public. And I think it's really important for people to understand what we're doing and understand why it's so important that we're doing what we're doing. And so I actually started to get active on Twitter and social media because I went to, I was at a scientific meeting and they had a session on using social media as a tool to be able to communicate not only to other scientists, but to the lay public. And I felt really passionate about doing that. And that's something that I felt like I really wanted to do. So I got involved in social media. I became the social media editor for the American Gastroenterological Association, which was really a wonderful tool to be able to communicate the awesome stuff that's going on in our gut research and be able to help communicate that to a broad public and to scientists. And I do think it's also been a really powerful way to connect with other scientists, especially all over the world. I made collaborations with people that I might not have necessarily met at the meetings that I go to, especially from in Europe and in Japan. And so this was a wonderful way for me to get to know people, get to know their research, and then get to ultimately collaborate with them. I have very positive things to say about social media, and I encourage everyone to join a social media platform. I think Twitter is a great and easy way to connect with people. But I also think that for the lay public, we have our lab has an Instagram page where we post immunofluorescence. I mean, as scientists, we take, you know, thousands of pictures if anyone's doing microscopy work, and we have all these images laying around. They don't all go into a paper. So it's fun to be able to post it and explain what we're showing, and then having a lay audience being like, I never knew mucus looks so beautiful, or wow, the gut is really pretty. It's not just disgusting. And I, you know, people think of gut, they think of poop, they think gross, but it's actually really beautiful in structure. And it's really cool to be able to see it. I think a picture says 1,000 words. So I really think it's a great tool to be able to connect with people that might be interested in science and don't know it.
Well, thank you, Mindy. Your passion for your area and for communication really comes across clearly. And we need more people like you working in science and communicating as you do. And thank you so much for joining us today. We really enjoyed this chat, and best of luck with your career. I'm sure it's going to be stellar.
I'm so excited to be here today. This was so fun.
The International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics, also known as ISAP, is a non-profit scientific organization dedicated to advancing the science of probiotics, prebiotics, symbiotics, postbiotics, and fermented foods. Follow along with our activities by searching for ISAP Science on your social media platform of choice, or visit www.isapscience.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.